Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today's economic news comes from Europe, $1 trillion to fix their debt crisis once and for all. And that blip the stock markets here had on Thursday? Well, they're still trying to figure out what happened on that one. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by PBS, presenting Into the Deep, America, Wailing in the World, on American Experience, tonight on PBS. Local times may vary. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 10th of May, and it is good to have you here. The economic stabilization agreement that Europe came to last night comes in at just shy of $1 trillion, American. We've been covering the debt crisis over there for a couple of months now, first and most prominently as a problem the Greeks were having, then more recently Portugal and Spain and also Italy. A good chunk of the south of Europe owes more money than it can pay back, and until last night didn't really have any hope of help. Ambrose Evans-Pritchard is the international business editor for London's Daily Telegraph newspaper. Mr. Evans-Pritchard, good to have you with us.
Nice to be with you again.
This is not the first time we've heard of a Greek debt rescue package or a European debt rescue package. Is it going to fix anything, this big package that was announced?
Well, they've been behind the curve for the last 4 months, endlessly promising more than they could really deliver, and the market's just called their bluff over Greece, but it got completely out of control last week. It was spreading to Portugal, Spain, and other countries. The borrowing costs was shooting up. You had credit stress of a kind we hadn't seen since the Lehman crisis in September of 2008, and they had to intervene on a serious scale, and that's what they finally done.
You mentioned Lehman Brothers. Let me ask you to frame this in terms of the American bailout of the banking system. Is this sort of analogous to the TARP and what we did for the banks over here?
Yeah, my view is this is potentially more dangerous than Lehman for two reasons. Firstly, the banking system in Europe is already vulnerable. It's already suffered a shock from the last crisis. And the thing to remember is that the U.S. subprime and property crisis, the consequences of that were shared between Europe and America. So the European banks are up to the neck in it as well. So they're taking a double hit. So there's another problem here. During the Lehman crisis, the governments around the world were able to step in. And nobody questioned their ability to do this. They assumed, well, governments, sovereigns have big shoulders. They can carry this burden. Unfortunately, we've now pushed this to the limits. And the markets are beginning to question whether governments can carry this burden. So you can't just step in and take over the obligations that easily when you've got some of the governments that are going to have to provide the money or already themselves in difficulties, and they've got combined debt levels of over 300% of GDP.
The analysis of the Greek debt problem almost from the beginning was that it would threaten the eurozone, all the countries that use the euro, and then destabilize the entire global economy. Can we now take from yesterday's announcement of this rescue package that European leaders finally bought into that analysis and they thought it really was a threat to the whole system?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair to some of the European leaders, I mean, some of them did understand this quite early on, and certain people in the European institutions did. The trouble is there is no European government, and that's what's been exposed in all of this. They launched the euro as a kind of orphan currency with no EU treasury, no EU debt union, no decision-making apparatus capable of backing it up in a crisis, and that's been shown. So this is the battle that's sort of going on, and it's very, very politically sensitive. And I think it's the reason why so many outside observers from outside Europe have not quite understood why they couldn't reach a deal. And it's not just about finding a mechanics of a deal on money. It's about what kind of political system is going to run Europe for the next 20 years. That's what this debate is really about.
In the slightly shorter term, then, what happens next? Do we just sit back and see if this agreement works and hold our breath?
Well, they bought some time.
Ambrose Evans-Pritchard at the Daily Telegraph in London. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks. Nice to be with you.
As long as we're talking about bailouts, I'm obliged to mention Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac here. Fannie announced a quarterly loss of $13 billion this morning and then promptly announced it needs another $8.5 billion from the Treasury Department to keep on going. The federal bailout of Fannie and its cousin in government receivership, Freddie Mac, is now $145 billion. The Senate is supposed to start debating the financial reform bill once again tomorrow. It's a bill that does not include an overhaul for either of the government-owned mortgage companies. From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
The Obama administration says it has to prop up Fannie and Freddie because they're propping up the housing market. They package mortgages into bonds and guarantee them. The government backed almost 97% of the home loans made in the first quarter of this year. Susan Wachter teaches real estate and finance at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School.
The support by the federal government, Fannie and Freddie, is the girding of the housing finance system, which is absolutely critical to the continued recovery of the overall economy.
Fannie and Freddie's guarantee helps keep mortgage interest rates low. Wachter says the housing market is too fragile now to even think about reforming Fannie and Freddie. A group of Republican senators disagrees. They've introduced an amendment to the financial overhaul. It would force the government to give up control of Fannie and Freddie within 2 years. Guy Sakala publishes Inside Mortgage Finance. He says it's good to start talking about Fannie and Freddie, but hard deadlines won't work.
There's nothing we're going to build in there that's going to start on September 1st, July 1, or whatever else. We're basically laying the groundwork for where we want to be in several years.
But Boston University finance professor Mark Williams says the time for reform is now, while the consequences of the financial meltdown are still fresh in our minds. And he wants Congress to keep Fannie and Freddie away from the types of risky investments that caused the financial crisis.
That's saying, hey, we had a fire. It was caused in part by these two entities, so they can't play with matches. Those matches will be put up on the shelf. So that's all preventive things that I think would be very effective, but yet it's not in the Senate bill itself.
The Obama administration says it'll come up with a game plan for Fannie and Freddie next year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Last week's momentary 1,000-point plunge in the Dow is the cause of a lot of head-scratching amongst market regulators. The leaders of a number of major stock exchanges met with the SEC today, and there was broad agreement that there should be a uniform system of what are called circuit breakers, ways to slow trading or stop it entirely in case of a sudden crash like we had last week. Because as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports, the way things are right now doesn't seem to be inspiring a whole lot of confidence.
As the market collapsed last Thursday, TV cameras were focused on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, but they probably should have been focused on a number of computers.
The New York Stock Exchange is really only a small part of trading overall in the U.S. There are dozens of other places that people trade.
Charles Jones is a finance professor at Columbia University. He's got no problem with multiple exchanges or electronic trading. Good for competition, he says. But he says the fact that no one's yet been able to pinpoint the cause of last week's crash indicates the mystery of today's marketplace.
It should not take 3 business days to figure out exactly what went wrong.
Doesn't really inspire confidence in the stock market, does it? If anyone can figure out what went wrong, it might be Jatin Suryawanshi, who heads up the algorithmic trading division at Jefferies. He describes today's landscape of stock exchanges as a series of computers that can talk to each other, but sometimes can't comprehend what the other is saying. Amid last Thursday's mayhem, he says the New York Stock Exchange went into a slow trading mode.
They went from an automated to a manual mode of trading, and that resulted in a lot of the market makers not being able to understand what is happening to their orders on one of the exchanges, and they started withdrawing.
He says uniformity is the key to fixing today's system and restoring confidence in fragmented markets. He says each exchange should always know what the others are doing. That should include circuit breakers, he says. So if stocks stop trading in one place, they stop trading everywhere. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Broken or not, the markets were up today big thanks to that European bailout, so it's going to be the happy music when we get there. But we're going to play a little stormy weather right now all the same, because Lena Horne died yesterday. We don't actually use her version when the numbers warrant, but she's the one who made stormy weather famous back in 1943. Here you go.
Don't know why there's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather since my man and I ain't together. Keeps raining all the time.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates found himself in Abilene, Kansas this weekend for a speech marking 65 years since the end of World War II in Europe. The United States has been a superpower all the time since. We spend more on our military than any other country does, and probably will for a while, too. But Gates said this weekend the Pentagon is going to have to start living at least closer to its means. Brett Neely has more.
Pentagon budget analysts have long said the cost of new weapons systems is out of control. In his speech at the Eisenhower Presidential Library, Gates said there's another threat.
Leaving aside the sacred obligation we have to America's wounded warriors, healthcare costs are eating the Defense Department alive.
The Pentagon spends $50 billion a year on healthcare, more than double what it did 10 years ago. Even retired service members who could be insured by their employer get cheap, government-subsidized insurance. Todd Harrison at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments says those costs are adding up.
So if you let that continue out into the future, eventually, you know, we have a military that's full of soldiers and airmen and Marines and sailors, but we don't have any trucks or planes or ships for them to use.
Harrison says the Pentagon is a lot like General Motors was before that company declared bankruptcy. GM made expensive promises to its workers that it eventually couldn't afford.
We're trading, you know, taking care of, you know, today's retirees as opposed to taking care of tomorrow's frontline soldiers.
Winslow Wheeler at the Center for Defense Information blames Congress. With two wars underway, he says voting to increase troop pay and benefits is always popular.
Congress has layered on additional unrequested benefits for survivors, for retirees, and it's all coming home to roost.
In his speech, Secretary Gates said Congress's generosity is admirable. But now that budgets are tight, he said it may be time for troops to pick up more of their own health care tab. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Economics is, at one level anyway, the study of incentives, how people react to different costs and benefits. Healthcare economics is that, but way more complicated. Incentives there have been tinkered with and regulated for decades. Solutions have been found, and then unanticipated consequences of those solutions become problems in themselves. And that brings us to our next story about prescription drug benefits for seniors. Actually, about what happens when those benefits go away, something called the donut hole. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
One thing about being a pharmacist is that you have to enforce rules that you did not make. Here at Friendly Pharmacy in North Philadelphia, pharmacist Brad Tabak spends more time than he'd like on the phone with customers delivering bad news.
It's an art form to be able to keep people happy by telling them no.
The reason Brad has to tell some of his customers no is that, according to Medicare rules, the government only pays for a certain amount of drugs per year. Seniors who pass that limit have to pay for the rest of their year's medication out of pocket. Suddenly, a drug that they'd been paying $3 for
could be hundreds of dollars. If someone's on three or four different blood pressure medicines, they'll ask us, which two should we forego if we're going to forego two?
Each year, over 500,000 seniors stop taking their medication because they fall into this gap in coverage. Medicare pays up to $2,800 in drug costs, and if you're on very expensive drugs and go over $6,400, the government will help pay for that, too. In between those two numbers is what's known as the donut hole, where seniors are on their own. The funny thing about the donut hole is that it was created by the very same bill that was passed to help seniors pay for drugs in the first place. A bill called Medicare Part D passed in 2004.
President Bush wanted to get Medicare Part D without a tax increase, and the only way he could figure out to keep the costs within some kind of constraint was to have a donut hole.
F.M. Scherer is a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Even with that donut hole, Medicare spent about $50 billion last year on drugs. But he says the donut hole was also designed to do something else, to give seniors an incentive to pay attention to how much their drugs actually cost.
Actually, I'm on Medicare, and I get a quarterly report telling me exactly how far from the donut hole I am. And it is a quarterly reminder that the donut hole is looming.
With enough time, conceivably, for a patient like Scherer to go to his doctor and say,
could you get me a generic, or could you find something that's less expensive?
Albert Wertheimer is an economist and a pharmacist at Temple University in Philadelphia. The economist side of him agrees with that incentive.
It's nice to make people, what do they call it now, putting some skin on the table.
But the pharmacist side of him worries that some seniors won't get the medication that they need. And so Wertheimer has mixed feelings about health care reform, which will eliminate the donut hole. Starting next year, big drug companies will be required to discount their brand drugs by 50% to seniors that fall in the hole. It's expected to cost the company some $3 billion a year. But it's not all pain, says pharmacist Brad Tabak.
This donut hole fix will definitely increase the amount of brand drugs dispensed.
Tabak says it will give seniors less incentive to switch to generics. He says his customers already prefer brand drugs, even if getting the brand means a higher copay. And it's only when they fall into the donut hole that they reconsider.
Because they don't have a choice, because they can't afford the brands. But I'm always left with the feeling that they're unhappy with me. And I leave the conversation saying, I wonder if they're going to switch pharmacies.
Brad doesn't want to be the messenger, the one who has to tell seniors they have to pick up their own tab. And under this new donut hole fix, no one, not the government, not the drug companies, and not Brad, has to be. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Coming up, do companies actually design things to become obsolete?
I don't think they do, because time is going to detonate the device itself. You know, just wait a year and it's worthless.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks rang up their biggest daily bounce in more than a year today. The Dow Industrials rose 404 points, 10,785, and advanced just shy of 4% this Monday. The NASDAQ surged 109 points, 2374, a dazzling 4.8%. The S&P 500 was spring-loaded with a record-setting jump right from the opening bell, ended the day up 48 points at 11.59, a gain of nearly 4.5%. That European bailout package we mentioned put a brighter spotlight on financial stocks. U.S.-listed shares of Spain's Banco Santander leapt 23%. British-based Barclays rose nearly 18%. Bank of America, Wells Fargo shares both cashed in with gains of nearly 7%. Today's Citigroup deposited 5.5%. Bonds suffered. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.54%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
For the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Tuesday. After the roller coaster on Wall Street last week, there will be a hearing on Capitol Hill titled The Stock Market Plunge: What Happened and What Is Next. First Lady Michelle Obama will release the findings of her childhood obesity task force. And 50 years ago today, the first oral contraceptive pill was introduced to the U.S. market. I'm Julia Simon.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. I don't know if you saw Saturday Night Live this weekend, but Betty White gave Facebook a big shout-out for helping her get the hosting gig. Something like 500,000 people on the social networking site clicked on the Like button on her fan page. You can use that button, Like, to flag all kinds of preferences that will then be shared with your friends and possibly eventually the whole internet. Your favorite music, what political or social causes you follow, pretty much anything. Commentator Farhad Manju explains the upsides and the down.
Every one of those likes, a billion statements of preference every day, 365 billion every year at least, will get filed back at Facebook HQ. It is difficult to overstate the value to Facebook of all this activity. Remember that the social network already has the world's largest database of connections between people. Now, very soon, it will also have the largest database connecting people to the things we enjoy, whether those things are news stories, restaurants, songs, books, movies, jeans, cosmetics, or anything else. No other company will have anything like Facebook's towering database of human intentions and desires, not even Google. Should we be worried about all this? Yes and no. I suspect that Facebook, like Google, will use its stash of data in ways that are wonderful and in ways that are creepy. This is the double-edged sword of a digital life. Big companies are tracking you all the time, and they're doing a lot of things you don't like with that information, including serving you ads. But all the data is also extremely useful, too. Google and Amazon, for instance, are powerful precisely because they know so much about you. It's only by keeping mountains of data that Google can predict when flu season will start or describe the traffic conditions on your morning commute. We're bound to see similar benefits from all of Facebook's personalized data. Think of how much more useful you'd find a shopping site if it made consistently good recommendations based on your known likes and dislikes. Or consider how much safer you'd feel signing up to a new tax preparation company if you saw that your friends had liked it. Thanks to Facebook's data, we can expect better movie recommendation apps, better dating sites, better online games, and probably a lot more. From now on, none of us will surf alone. People you trust can help you organize and vet every corner of the web. And Facebook will be at the center of it all.
Farhad Manju covers technology for Slate. Take a minute to send us your thoughts, whether you like us or you don't. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Not to give too much credence to a slightly cliched phrase, but there is something about springtime that just makes you want to clean, to get rid of all the clutter and toss all the stuff crammed in the garage or in the attic that just doesn't work anymore, whether by overuse or by corporate design. Planned obsolescence used to actually be policy in a lot of places, something companies started doing back in the 1920s to counter the never-ending precision of mass assembly lines. Consumer life has gotten better over the years since, or has it? Cash Peters wanted to know.
This is ridiculous. So many appliances I buy turn out to be complete duds. Why? Because manufacturers make products that break easily, that's why. Just so as we'll keep buying new ones. Professor Gerard Tellis is a marketing whiz at USC's Marshall School of Business.
What you're saying does happen in some countries and for some companies.
So some companies say, let's build a really bad product.
Sure, there are companies like that.
It's a scandal. And it means that right now, I have a juicer that makes horrible noises. Right, that's my juicer. The knobs just fell off my fruit dehydrator. And when I bought a Cuisinart electric griddle, the hot plates... There you go, they snapped and dropped out. Well, that's when I snapped too, quite honestly. I was right on the phone to Mary Rogers, Cuisinart's head of marketing communications. Grrr! Basically was my message to her. But Mary denies it's all rigged.
I've worked in the housewares industry for 20 years, and never have I worked for anybody who has done anything related to planned obsolescence.
But maybe they wouldn't tell you.
Of course. I mean, I'm at a pretty high level at the company, and we do not work on a planned obsolescence.
All right. What's amazing is that according to the Better Business Bureau's Gary Almond, if you buy a defective product, you know who's to blame? You are. For not doing more research. Shame on you, frankly.
I think people, you know, take very casually when they buy something. You know, they don't look at the Better Business Bureau reports. They don't go out and see what the consumer reviews are.
It's our fault, actually.
It is.
Wow, I feel terrible now. So, all right, I didn't research my griddle very well. But wouldn't the problem have been solved if the manufacturer had just tested it before it left the factory? Then this might have happened to them instead. Mary.
We actually put a lot of time and effort into life testing our products. We design them so that they are, you know, meant to last much longer than other products in the same categories.
Actually, if you lived closer, I would challenge you to a cook-off on my griddle to make so- I want to
I
see.
I make a pretty mean panini.
Believe me, you're going to be sobbing into your apron within 10 minutes. I'm not kidding either. But here's what's really interesting. David Sarno is the tech reporter for the LA Times, and he says planned obsolescence is itself obsolete, especially in electronics, where manufacturers no longer need to sabotage their own products to make you buy a new one.
I don't think they do, because time is going to detonate the device itself. You know, just wait a year and it's worthless. So suddenly you're in the dark ages, even though the device you owned is only a year or two old.
God, they're so smart. The best news is that many consumers are going on the internet and giving terrible products one-star reviews, which is forcing manufacturers to make stuff that works. Gerard, tell us.
Quality is not coming down. Quality is going up. On average, looking at long-term trends, the proportion of breakdowns is lower, I think, now than before. It's just a matter of probability. I mean, there are so many products and so many people that some people will end up with lemons.
Right. And I will be a good example of that. Faulty dehydrators, useless griddles.
I have to tell you, I have an original griddler. I use it all the time. I've never had that happen to any griddler I've used.
Do you think I'm jinxed? Is that what it is? Do you think I'm just hexed?
No. I don't think you're hexed.
It is what it is. You know, you got a few failures and a few thousands, and then some things are just, they're bad. They're sold bad.
Nothing well, I've ever bought has gone right.
Really, well, how's this microphone working for you?
Oh, do you want to hear?
Yeah,
another fine American product for the Better Business Bureau to investigate. In Los Angeles, I'm Cash Peters for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help you meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a lesson in how perfection can sometimes be overrated. Goldman Sachs, as we know, has been having its problems, an SEC fraud investigation. Chairman and CEO Lloyd Blankfein spending long hours in front of congressional committees, but Goldman's trading desks didn't miss a beat in the first quarter. Bloomberg News pointed out today that Goldman's traders made money, often lots of it, every single working day of the first quarter. No losses at all. Apparently, Goldman's never done that before, but investors still aren't impressed. Company shares still off 20% from the day the SEC case was filed. And on that note, that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow packed on 404 points. That is 4% after that European deal that was announced late last night. The NASDAQ up 109, 4.8%. The S&P 500 up 48, almost 4.5%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this program, ways for the poor to make a profit.
There is actually spending power in that 4 billion people that were written off from formal marketing strategies.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.